Welcome to The Sober Show with Andy and Helen. Today, we're going to be talking to Martin Smith, MBE. We met Martin only 2 weeks ago at the NEC Birmingham at the National Cybersecurity Show, where they basically put on the entire event. And sat right in the middle was the delightful Martin, who just told us an amazing story about how he went from almost causing World War III right through to cybersecurity today, from a time when computers didn't really exist at all, actually. Andy, you've got a little bit more information about Martin.
Our guest comes from a background in Air Force intelligence and is the founder of perhaps the most interesting of all British cyber forums, the SASIG, SASIG, which is the Security Awareness Special Interest Group. Welcome to the show, Martin.
I am delighted to be here.
When we met at the National Cyber Show in Birmingham last month, I heard you say that SASIG is one of the best kept secrets in the industry. So today we're here to raise awareness of security awareness a little more. SASIG certainly isn't a secret organization, but it does have a particular flavor, which I understand is decidedly non-commercial in its primary aims, and rather exists to promote intelligence sharing. Are we understanding that correctly, Martin?
You are, and the genesis of SASIG, I believe, is unique, and our DNA is quite unique.
Company.
It would be naive and disingenuous to say that there wasn't a commercial motive behind all of it, but our difference is that we put the delegates, the members first. All other networking events and of conferences and all the rest, they all put the vendor first.
Yes.
But we've always been a member organisation, and I'll tell you the story. I don't think anybody can see me on this. It's an audio podcast, but I'm very old. I've been around a long, long time. I got into computer security, as we called it then, back in 1981. Now, this was before networking. It was way before the internet. It was really before computers. I was in the Air Force, and we had big command and control systems, copper cables, green screens, and none of us knew anything. We were all moving into this space just by fingertips, really, making it up as we went along. The Air Force was leading the charge amongst the three services and the MOD. Nobody wanted the job because we were all a bit scared of computers, but never one to hold back. I volunteered because I recognized back then that, hang on a minute, this is going to be huge. These were in the days where they were saying that there'll only be four computers in the country. So in 1981, I agreed to write the first ever training for the military on computer security. And we developed some computer security training courses, which in essence still exist today. You can still see the form in them. And that was done when I was at RAF Abingdon. And they were, still are, absolutely groundbreaking, but we didn't know what we were doing. I pulled together a lunch at the officers' mess at RAF Brampton, where I was based, and we had about 20 people around the table, which was everybody in the UK that were working in this field. I kid you not. And about six or seven of those went on to be the committee that developed the first British standard 7799. So we are talking really early days, and none of us knew anything, and we just developed it as we went along. I'm a behavioral psychologist by training. I'm a communicator, I think, by nature. I'm not a techie. I know the techie because I've been in it since the beginning, but I don't focus on that. I left the Air Force in the early 90s and trained myself to become a civilian. So I worked for Deloitte and I worked for Kroll Associates, and I was what we would now call the CISO for the Standard Chartered Bank. So it was in 97, I decided to start my own movement, as it were, to emphasize the human elements of computer security. So I formed my own company, which was focused on security awareness. And how can I put this? The Air Force is run by pilots. The NHS is run by doctors. Businesses are run by accountants. And the cybersecurity world was, and to a great extent still is, run by techies. Which is fine, except even then I recognize, and it's so true today, that the greatest threat surface is the human layer. Mm-hmm. And if you look at where all of the incidents occur today, they all emerge from that human layer. So it doesn't matter how much technology we have in place, it's still the people where the baddies will come through. What has changed is that people are beginning at last to recognize that. So I always wanted to develop the human side of the cybersecurity story. But the biggest problem was that no one was really interested in it. So in 2004, I developed the Security Awareness Special Interest Group, and it was to raise awareness about security awareness. That was its original intent. But quickly it morphed into just general computer security awareness because it was still such a new topic and so many people in business didn't really understand it. Well, they did. They understood exactly about computer security. It was something that the computer security people took care of and no one in the business themselves needed to worry, okay? This is something for the CIO, but it wasn't. It never was and it still isn't. So I wanted to develop that human level, and the Security Awareness Special Interest Group started to grow during the period 2004 to about 2014-15, to a point where we had a couple of thousand interested people, and we were doing quite a number of events to the point where I could no longer run it as my hobby. Now, one of the key aspects of the Security Awareness Special Interest Group, SASIG, is that it's a vendor-free environment. It's a sales-free environment. We were chatting at the beginning, Andy, and most, if not all, other events, meetings, forums, they're all focused on the vendor community. It's them that pay for it, so it's them that calls the tunes. The SASIG has never been that way around. It's always been for the members. It's a CISO safe zone. It's where we can all get together and discuss issues without being sold to or sold at or however you want to put it. So we get to 2014 and we've now got about 2,500 members and I can no longer run this on my own, but I need help. How do I pay for it? And my dilemma was an absolute catch-22. How can I ask vendors to sponsor the SASIG if the first thing I'm going to say to them is, you can't sell to them? So my gorgeous wife, who is also my business partner, my mentor, my muse, and all the rest of it, who's been with me since the start, she said, well, have you asked anybody? Well, of course I haven't. Have you asked them? Well, no, because ask them. So I did. And I rang a few mates, and they said, Martin, we would love to be part of the SASIG. We don't want to sell to the community. We want to be part of the community. We want to learn from the community. We want to understand what the CISOs and their teams need, want. What's their views? What's their opinions? We want to learn from them. Now, that sounds really, really cheesy, but I promise you it's not. It came from the heart. And within a couple of years, we had a core of 16 supporters. We call them supporters, not sponsors, but supporters because they support us. And they're inside our circle of trust. They are the only vendors who have access to the community, and they work to a strict charter, which basically says, behave. So the SASIG uniquely is for the members, not for the vendors. We consider it, our members consider it a CISO safe zone. And the supporters that joined us wanted to be inside that circle of trust. They wanted to learn from the community and contribute to it. And it works an absolute dream. They sign up to a charter, and in return, the members agree to behave themselves with the vendors. There are a lot of vendors who are seen by the CISO community as the enemy. And to be fair, a lot of them behave like the enemy, so therefore, it's not surprising they get treated like the enemy. There are some CISOs out there who also don't necessarily always behave as they should. My view is very, very clear. The CISO and the vendor should interact as equals. Both sides are essential to the solution. The CISO must have product and the vendors must be able to sell those products to the community. So the SASIG premise is that the vendors and the users meet as equals and it works a treat. Lockdown arrives and suddenly we can do nothing. I did something which I'm still to this day very proud of. I suddenly realized at lockdown we had 3,000 mates, all terrified, all stuck at home with husbands and wives and kids and dogs, and we're all going to die because the government's told us so. We're all going to lose our jobs because the government told us so. It's only 5 years ago, but we've forgotten already. So on day three of lockdown, I said to Danny King, my managing director, and a team of two I think we had in those days, let's do a webinar. Yes, when? I mean every day at 11 o'clock. And within a week, we'd spun up and we did a webinar every day, all during lockdown and beyond. We're still doing a webinar almost every day, 11 o'clock, so that the whole community had somewhere to come to. We talked about anything. We talked about cybersecurity, divergence, inclusion, about mental health and welfare, leadership, change management. We did anything we could to keep the community together. And over that two-year period, we went from 3,000 to over 9,000 members. I am absolutely delighted that we could do that for the community. After lockdown, we went back into the real world and we now do two major events a month. The last 3 years, we've grown to over 11,000 members. And that all carries on. So there is a SASE gig going on every day of the week. Every working day of the year, we're putting on either a webinar or an in-person event or something else. We do dinners and we do workshops, roundtables, things like that. All still focused on the members, all still supported by an increasing number of, we have our supporters, but we have a growing band of what we call contributors, which are trainee supporters, as it were, all of whom sign up to the charter, all of whom are inside the circle of trust, and all of whom make a strong point of contributing to the debate. They offer about two-thirds of our content, and it allows the vendors to build those long-term relationships. There's another issue in the cyber world. CISOs operate on trust. They will buy from people they know and trust. They won't buy from people they don't know and trust. But how does a vendor get to know and be known and trusted? And there's that virtual spiral that we break because we allow the vendors, the good ones, the honest Johns, the ones that get through the vetting process, we allow them to spend time getting to know the community so that when the user knows, has a need, they know where to go. It's a slow burn. I often refer to it as growing oak trees, not pine trees. The discerning vendor, the supporters and our contributors, they value their place at the SASE table very highly indeed. Vendors simply couldn't get in front of users. So we put on a two-day virtual field marketing event, which we called Big SASE, because it was a big SASE. We did it 2 days online and everybody loved it. When we came out, we decided that we'd do that once a year. And that's our Big SASE. And our Big SASE number 5 is next week. The Big SASE, it's a sales event. So everybody comes to it knowing that it's a sales event. The members come knowing that they're going to be sold to, and the partners, the supporters, the contributors know that they're allowed to sell. And we set it all up in advance so that we can pre-arrange meetings and one-to-ones. It's absolutely unique. Big SASE is a swingers party where everybody comes knowing what they're going to do. And the other thing I say about Big SASE is that if you think of the large trade shows, which have their place, and I'm a great supporter of them, you know, something like InfoSec or ICE from 19 Group, hundreds, thousands of people, it's a street party. You have no idea who these people are. It's a lot of fun, a lot of noise, a lot of activity. Everybody enjoys themselves. Big SASE, I always refer to as a dinner party. The only people there are vetted SASE members or vetted SASE partners. And you know that the people there are the people you want to talk to. There isn't a huge crowd in front of you. There's a very smaller, much smaller select crowd of people that that you want to meet.
You're listening to The Cyber Show.
Just over a year ago, 19 Group, who run the International Cyber Expo and the National Cyber Security Show, where we met a couple of weeks ago, they do massive trade shows all around the world on an all host of topics. They do the International Security Expo at Olympia, which is a massive show. They're moving into the cyberspace, and we were acquired by 19 Group a year ago in order to help build their cyber story. And that is now emerged as the 19 Cyber Series, which is ICE, NCSS, Big SASE, our daily events, and everything that goes with them. I'm very excited by that. I'm energized by it. As I said right at the beginning, about 3 days ago when we started talking, it only seems like that, I'm sure. But I had intended to retire in lockdown. But I always imagined that the SASE was like a single-engined aeroplane flying over cloud. As long as I kept going, everything was fine. But if I decided to stop, then the aeroplane crashes. It's got nowhere to land. 19 Group came into view. And so it was like an opening in the clouds. I've now found my landing ground and it is a lovely place. The 19 Group team are just the most wonderful crowd of people. Peter Jones, the boss there, has had huge faith in what we're doing and is supporting us all the way through. So Joe, my wife and I are coming up towards the end of our earnout period, but I've every intentions of continuing if they'll have me, to develop the SASIG model and stand us apart from the myriad of other shows and networking forums and organizations, all of whom have their qualities, but none of them are quite like us.
I think this topic of building human relations will run and run, and we are very much on the same page. We are all about layer 8 and layer 9, as we call it, what we call civic cybersecurity, and the idea that, you know, as we've moved into a technological society, this has become a remit of every mother and grandmother and school child, that it's really about people and it's about trust and it's about human relations. So,
Andy, it's absolutely crucial. I cannot emphasize that enough. If you're selling most other things, people just buy from you. I've just bought a car online. You know, a commodity item. A car is now a commodity item and you just buy it. Cyber's different, and I don't know why, and I can't think how we might change it, which I don't think we can. So let's accept it. The CISO community are a certain sort, and everything that we do is based on trust, because what we're dealing in are massive issues of privacy and trust and security and you know, it's all about trust. And vendors will try to sell product to the cyber community in the same way as we've always sold product to any sector. And it doesn't work in our community. Yes, it does to a degree, but that trust has to be there before the CISO community will throw themselves into it.
And I wanted to discuss how the technology is now moving into layer 8. We spoke to Node before, and they are one of a few that are developing basically a guardian that will tell you yes or no. Well, that's a whole new layer 8 problem. That when we bring tech into that psychological space, well, now the tech can be hacked and tell somebody, yeah, you can click that. That's not helpful to some extent. This is the problem again, is that we keep trying to put technology on people in places where it doesn't belong.
It's interesting, isn't it? Wherever you put technology to solve a problem, you've kind of moved somewhere else.
Yeah, literally. They'll just find a way around that. They'll just find a way of tricking the robot into tricking the human. So it will just change the attack surface.
That's a really interesting point, Helen, because if you think, well, if it's happening at, like, say, the presentation layer, and you are suspicious about something, then you're going to make your own decision as an operator. But if you've moved it into a Sentinel, Guardian, some sort of AI chatbot thing, which is your, what's the term that Microsoft use, Copilot, whatever, that's supposed to be there to say, oh, everything's fine. Yes, you can click that. That is not a phishing link and whatever. Then actually, that's a much more dangerous attack surface, because you've already created trust in that pseudo entity. And then when it betrays you because you hacked it, wow.
Yeah, it flies in the face, actually, of sort of that zero trust architecture that we talk about so much on the show, is that you're putting your trust into something that potentially is hooked up to an internet, to an AI service that you don't have any organizational control over. So again, we look at what we've been talking about this season on the Cyber Show. Does that mean that when governments come in and they start fiddling with systems and fiddling with things, or a private company starts behaving immorally, or it doesn't like a competitor, can it then actually use that against somebody else, right?
It absolutely can, yeah. And one of the things that we've already heard about in machine learning, in the training of models, bias is being deliberately injected in for advertising purposes. So if Meta or OpenAI or whoever are training a system, and I come along and I'm Tesco's, for example, right. I can say, here's a sum of money and I want you to bias your responses towards my products. So, yeah, I mean, that's just the commercial side of it. Imagine what can happen with what we've already seen with poisoning of data, which a lot of artists are doing now, quite rightly so, I think. I think that's a reasonable response to having your stuff just stolen. Poisoning the training data. Well, anyone can poison the training data and make it perform malware-type actions when it encounters a certain question or whatever. That is crazy.
Yeah, and it's not going to prepare us for those really difficult social engineering attacks. I mean, the way that We have to teach people to be smarter every single day. When bad actors come up with a new method of getting in or tricking someone, we have to go out immediately and explain how that trick works. If you're just trusting this device, you're disconnecting the human once more from that thinking process. And we're seeing that actually quite a lot in academia and teaching, is that when someone's using an AI chatbot, they're not actually thinking, they're not engaging their brain. They are copying and pasting. That's what their brain's taking from it. It's just ask a question, copy, paste. We're going to miss a lot of opportunity to train people and make them better in their jobs if we rely on these tools.
SASIG playing a bigger role in human factors in layer 8 and layer 9 stuff. We have a whole quest ahead of us to educate people in whole new threat landscapes that exist now, yeah?
Yeah, Martin was very clear about that with what he said as well, is that it is an issue that affects everybody. That's absolutely been identified. You know, these are CISOs who are working for companies and vendors who supply them software. And they're sitting around saying, well, actually, this problem exists everywhere. It's at home and it exists on a societal level, and asking a team of techies to solve a societal level issue in individual little silos is probably not going to be a way to fix anything, and it hasn't worked so far.
No, I don't think it's going to work at all. And what I worry is that we're entering an era where people can't manage that level of mistrust. No matter how much we educate them and however much we encourage them to be vigilant, people just can't use technology and at the same time maintain that level of vigilance. It's too exhausting. So we might end up with a kind of weird situation where we have to choose between technology and security.
Maybe we made that decision when we all picked up our smartphones.
Yeah, right. Okay. Well, that's an interesting comment, isn't it? And I think we've kind of said it before in writing. Cybersecurity is a failure and it can't succeed. So it's a lost cause already from the beginning. That's the bleakest thing that I can think of.
Hey, look, it's still going. The bank is still running today. So it's working. We're winging it correctly at this point, despite the issues. I'm trying to bring some hope in. Yeah, everyone's in their jobs just winging it, right? So the whole world's winging it. Bad guys are, so are the good guys. But society is still functioning for another day. The sun is setting. We did it, guys. We got there.
I always say to people joining us as supporters or contributors, this is not a sales environment. If you're coming in for ROI, forget it. The ROI will take a year or two or three, but it'll be there absolutely solid. They've made 50, 100, 200 new relationships, which takes a year or two to work through. But no, they go, because they're off now for the next golden bullet and there isn't one.
Well, they're fools, because the human capital is absolutely invaluable. And trust is such a complex, multi-layered thing. There's assumptions and presumptions and deceptions and hedging of bets. And trust isn't just a little kind of like scale that you can put on Facebook.
Suppliers, marketing people, salespeople in vendors, they're not fools. They will not acknowledge that this needs a different emphasis. That's all.
So, do we know why that there's that reluctance?
Well, now we're getting into an area where I'm very nervous about criticizing people. My observations, it's always easy for all of us to do things the way we've always done them. So rebooking for next year, if we've done it for the last 5 years, we'll just do it. And it takes a significant amount less effort and much less risk than trying to do things differently. I've always been a disruptor. People think that disruption and destruction are the same things. They're not. Every aspect of our daily lives, we should be constantly disrupting to try and make things better. I know this sector. I have been in this sector since Pontius was a pilot, let alone me. So I know this sector. I know the CISO community. They've grown up alongside me. I know how they work. Big Classic 2 years ago, we had our opening keynote presentation, and it was called the Vendor Value Proposition. And I had six of the most senior CISOs in the UK sat on the stage for the opening keynote. We got everybody in the keynote, all the vendors, all the suppliers, all the delegates, all the speakers, standing room only. And the discussion for an hour from these CISOs is, this is what makes us buy. This is what turns us off. This is what we want from you today. This is what we don't want to hear. We don't like marketing emails. We don't like mail shots. We don't like cold calls. We don't like you promising us the world when we know you can't do it. So, and we gave the community, so the delegates and the vendors, the partners, we gave them the crib sheet for the day. Honestly, that last 2 years ago, that big SASIG started like everybody was at an absolute high. I was so pleased. I came out, one of our partners got me to one side and he said, thank you, Martin, for that. I said, oh, you're my pleasure. He said, yeah, I am never going to get that hour back in my life. And I went, what? He said, yep, I've had to sit there for an hour listening to those people tell me how to do my job. And I just, my jaw dropped. They never came back. And the attitude was, I know better than my customer. There's a saying, the customer always knows best. It actually says, the customer always knows best what they want. The customer doesn't always know best, but they certainly know best what it is that they want. So vendors trying to tell users what it is that they want, vendors trying to give users their solutions, regardless of what the problem is, no longer works. No longer works. And we need a radical rethink about how we are going to break that loop. And I absolutely believe that the SASIG model breaks that loop. I don't know of anybody else that does it the way that we do it. And we've always done it that way for 21 years. This is our 21st year now. And we've always been for the members, and we've always put the members first and asked the vendors and the suppliers and the sponsors. Remember, we've only had them for the last 10 years. The first 10 years we did it on our own. We've always asked them to be respectful and to listen and learn. And it works absolute dividends.
You're listening to The Cyber Show on www.cybershow.uk. So we take the rebel's idea of Matthew's side position and think that cybersecurity benefits from all kinds of outlooks and life stances. So the SASIG membership is open to all, regardless of their background, their race, their disability, sexually, gender, what they identify with. Does the tide turn against DEI in the USA, weaken its security option, in your opinion?
I don't want to get into the DEI debate because that is just a route to madness.
Right.
What I am saying is that we must be much more inclusive. We also need to look at every single route we can for recruitment. Okay, so we're talking about inclusion. We can no longer be a crowd of white male geeks. Now, I've now offended the vast majority. I haven't, because I don't mean it that way. But for so long, the cybersecurity industry has been run by techies, which in the main were male and still are to a lot extent. We have to do so much more now to break that mold. And we are. I'm very encouraged. SASIG has twice as many women in our membership as the industry average. A lot of our female members enjoy SASIG, and it's been fed back to me countless times because they feel safe. I don't know quite what they mean by safe. It worries me that they use that word, but it's an environment where one can feel safe, and it includes race and gender.
You're listening to The Cyber Show on www.cybershow.uk.
We should have ethnic minorities in cybersecurity. We should have neurodivergence in cybersecurity, and that's coming, and it's important.
Neurodivergence is a big part of what we're already seeing when we're educators anyway, because you know when you've got neurodivergent people in your classroom, because they really do light up your classroom. They bring skills and knowledge and ways of thinking that the rest of the students don't have, and they're absolutely vital. But then we forget that on the employment side, that half of the students that are coming through that are really skilled are probably neurodivergent. Oh,
yeah. Well, let's just pause there. The employment side. It's HR looking for your recruits, and they're operating to outdated job specs that require you to be professors of everything before you can even get an internship. And their process for recruitment will push away the neurodiverse and will probably push away women, because women feel less comfortable. I'm saying this with some confidence because we've had a lot of conversations about this. But a woman will look at a job interview and think, I can't do that.
Yep.
A man will look at that job interview and think, oh, that's easy, I can do that. There's a rewire there. I'm not really comfortable about this bit because I'm laying myself open to all sorts of criticisms here. But it's coming from skills shortage is not going to go away. And there's a lot of people doing some really good work in this space. But the demand for our trade is outstripping the supply that we can feed it. The criminals are more motivated and have more time all day to do the badness than we have to defend ourselves. And they've got countless budget. They can just spend the money they're making from us to make more. we've got limited budgets, limited resource, limited bandwidth. We're always going to be on the back foot here. Not to say we shouldn't carry on trying, but it's always going to be difficult for the defender to defend. There are always examples in the press. There's plenty of examples going on at the moment where there, but for the grace of every man's God, goes the rest of us. You know, all of us are, it's not a case of if we get hacked or if we get attacked. It's a case of when and what does it look like.
The issues that we've probably had in cybersecurity at that layer 8 is a representation issue. We represent that cybersecurity incidences only really happen at that corporate level. When they don't, they happen to everybody from all different backgrounds. It can happen to you at work, can happen to your home. The boundaries between our workplaces and homes are being blurred in a consistent fashion. And we're all expected to suddenly be experts in IT in our jobs, whether we've been trained in that or not. So it really does seem to be that there's these huge elements. It's not just a skills gap, it's a skills gap across everybody. We're given new technology, but we're not trained realistically on how to use that technology in a safe and secure environment. So how do we tackle that with information sharing?
I remain utterly at loss as to why 90% of data breaches happen at the human level, but 90% of security budgets, IT security budgets, are spent at the technical level. It doesn't, but I know why it happens, because we're run by techies who spend money on things they understand. But if 90% of your problem receives 10% of your budget, that needs a revisit. If you go back to the beginning of lockdown, we were in the shadows as an industry. We were locked usually under the CIO, and we were only there as a cost center. We went into lockdown and suddenly we needed to work from home. I don't believe we could have survived as a world. I don't think we could have survived lockdown without cyberspace. We shopped in cyberspace. We banked in cyberspace. We communicated in cyberspace. We did everything in cyberspace. Somebody gave the definition of lockdown as when the middle class stayed at home and the working class brought them things. Harsh, but true. We could not have operated without cyberspace. We could not have operated in cyberspace unless we were safe and secure. So the fact that we could devolve thousands, millions of laptops to people's front rooms and operate securely in a very short space of time, the cybersecurity industry came to its own. We saved the world. Cyberspace saved the world, and cybersecurity saved cyberspace. So post-lockdown, we were on a high. We were now on the top table. Suddenly, cybersecurity became the absolute enabler for all business. 3 years later, those lessons are disappearing. And you see examples in the press every day where if only organizations had spent more preventing breaches, they would not only have not suffered the massive inconvenience and reputational loss of a major breach, but the cost, factors of tens, hundreds of what it would have cost to have put some basics in place. And then my third point of this is, it is the basics, and the basics apply at home and at work. There's half a dozen things. NCSC have been publishing this for years now. There's half a dozen things. If you get them right, 90% of your threat risk disappears. But we still don't address those half a dozen things. And there is no excuse. There is no excuse. I'm getting innovated now. It's not too late, but we still don't do enough. And the cybersecurity story is still vital to the success of all organizations. There is no excuse for not doing the basics, for not addressing the skills gap so that we're ready for the future, and for not capitalizing on the huge progress we made during lockdown when we saved the world, and we're happy to drop back into the shadows.
Our job with the Cyber Show and with Boudica Cybersecurity is that we educate and inform people and help them to be intellectual self-defense, digital self-defense. We hope that by getting people young, by getting governments to introduce curricula into schools that, you know, start at sort of 6, 7, 8 years old, that by the time those young people have grown up, they have a very different attitude to technology than our generations have, and that there's a new kind of digital literacy
there's 90% of our attack surface is currently being exploited via social engineering, but we're only spending 10% of our budget on that. So this is part of it. I mean, that's a way to tackle social engineering is education and starting at a much younger age. If we think about all the wasted servers and all the wasted Windows 10 computers that are going in the bin in the next year, and we put all of that budget instead, even if it was just an extra 40%, so it was half and half, we could have tackled that problem maybe a decade ago. It is strange that a lot of cybersecurity in 2025 is a human issue, and we don't have psychologists, and we don't have people like Martin, people like Dr. Kate Brown, who works with us, moving into those industries. It still seems to be a job for the IT department and the HR to train people on their civic cybersecurity, to train people how to make sure they are actually talking to their personal bank when they're on their work laptop. You know, this is what I mean about that boundary merging, is that we can't just say, well, you can be good at work, but you can be naughty at home, because, well, actually, you're answering your work emails on your personal device.
What do you think is the best way to go about this? Do we take psychologists and people, mm-hmm. and train them to be technical and understand things so that they can explain cybersecurity problems to everyone? Or do we train already technical people in human factors and psychology so that they can become, you know, the same? I mean, which way round is best?
We need to find the middle. That there should be some sort of psychologist or doctor working in your team of techies, right? And I'm going to go full geek here, but we all saw that on The Enterprise, right? Just throwing that in. Yeah. There is always a head doctor. There is always someone who's like, wait, I think this is a trick.
Are we talking Beverly Crusher or Deanna
Troi? We're talking
Troi?
More Deanna Troi, right? Because she can like feel the bad guys. Like, that's what I'm thinking. We need like someone on your SOC team who can feel a fish, even when it's really good. They can feel that they're being played, you know? And we've just seen that the retail hacks that have happened in the last 2 weeks, that was a social engineering attack to IT. So imagine if we had a crusher or one of those doctors in that room, they could have been like, wait, hang on. Do you really know that that's a person who works here? Mm-hmm. Have you seen their face? What do you mean you couldn't be bothered to walk 3 floors down to have a look at them? Yeah, because that's part of the issue. It really is.
Yeah, yeah. And then at the same time, there's this massive corporate pressure to act rashly, to think quickly, to be productive, to take things on trust and face value, because that's profitable for people who make money from users acting in a very shallow way, but completely in tension with security.
It does feel that if lockdown had gone on for another 2 or 3 years, which would have been awful for us all, but if it had, then we probably would have got to a state where things were non-reversible, where the cyberspace would have been where we work, and that those boundaries between home and workplace would have forever been cemented, and we would have started to learn some of those lessons.
Well, they're pretty cemented now, you know. Everybody's lifestyle's changed, much for the better.
Absolutely. I agree with that. But there is this push to go back into the workplace, to go back into the office.
Well,
and some of the argument for that will be cybersecurity. Oh, it's more secure. But not if your systems are set up right and you're following those basics that you mentioned. It should be just as secure as being in an office.
But working from home does not just suffer security issues. It suffers social issues, training issues, mental health and welfare issues. Bigger issue than just cyber. We would enable it, but whether people go back to work or not, I don't think it's not relevant as to whether they're secure at home. They are secure at home. We fix that.
Let's move on to that, if we may, Martin, and talk about that, because we had a question on mental health.
Yes.
Difficult work needs support.
So the group's social statement stresses that mental wellness, from the website SASIC, highlights the importance of mental health, normalising open and honest conversations in a demanding IT security environment. Many of us deal with toxic material and negative interactions, from common work anxiety to trauma of personal threats or exposure to disturbing materials. We've got burnout, paranoia, isolations, particularly in tech and cybersecurity. These are all common sufferings. Wellness often arises from just having people to talk to or knowing you have support. How are we going to be doing that if we're not having groups like this? That's my main question, is that this clearly was needed for a very long time. You've really nailed that on the head there. Having a group for CISOs to go and just talk to and also speak back to their vendors, how does that help with that mental health?
All jobs, all roles carry with them those things you mentioned. There's nothing particularly special with the cybersecurity role than there is a lot of other roles. HR people suffer all those things. Operations people, we all suffer the stresses of modern life. There are some roles that do present additional stresses. Yes, there are. Of course there are. But I think a lot of what we're facing in the cyber world is merely a reflection of those same effects elsewhere. The problem with the cyber world is that we start off by being relatively insular. Our natural tendency is to withdraw into ourselves. That's why the cyber world is so private and so secret, is because for generations now, we've been holding the world away, saying we're cyber, we're special. We're not, we're just people. We believe in the SASIG that the most important thing to be able to do is to share your feelings with others in the same place as you, which is where our networking groups come from, which is where our webinars on this topic were particularly important. I remember a couple during lockdown in particular where we discussed suicide and we had speakers and they were saying, don't say, are you all right? You know, you're not going to do anything silly, are you? Just say to them, you're not contemplating taking your own life, are you? And I had such a flood of good wishes after that, saying, gosh, I've never thought of it like that. Or I wish somebody had said those things to me when I was down. I was a bit shocked thinking, I can't say that to somebody. Anyway, the situation arose about a year later and I was chatting to somebody online like this who was having a really hard time and he was in tears. And I just said, you're not thinking of taking your own life, are you? And he went, I think I might be. And then we had a whole conversation about it. There was another occasion when, I don't know if you saw The Tinder Swindler on Netflix, I decided we'd do a romance fraud webinar. And I managed to get the lovely lady from The Tinder Swindler, Cecilia, the main protagonist, and she came on and talked. We found a couple of other people. Afterwards, one woman rang me up, I know her very well, and she said, well, thank you for that. I said, you enjoy? She said, not really, I've just realized that my partner's a romance fraudster. She said, you've just saved me from years of torment. Little things like that, where we can't save the world. I can't save the world. None of us can. But we can be there and we can provide an environment. And I know that people talk to each other in the community, in the SASIG community, and help each other out as a result of the sorts of things that we've discussed. We had the most amazing academy of speakers. All our members volunteer to talk on all these topics. We have people who are specialized in this, and charities to support service people coming out of the services, charities to support alcoholics, things like that. All we need to be able to do is find someone we can have a chat with. Lockdown stopped that, but we gave the environment. Working from home doesn't help.
But I would like to know, what are the most important components of healthy information sharing?
I am old school. I came from pre-computer era and talked about document security and classifications. Those things are still so important, but have got lost. So the most important thing when it comes to sharing information, in my opinion, is to identify the valuable stuff. You can't protect everything. You don't want to protect everything. It's human nature to share information. But we need to identify that information that, if shared inappropriately, can cause damage and harm to ourselves or others. That's something that's got lost. I often ask when I'm speaking to people, how many in the audience have an information classification scheme in their organizations? About half the people put their hands up, which means that half of the organizations don't even consider information classification. So then I say, would you keep your hand up if you consider that information classification scheme works? I don't think anybody's ever kept their hand up. What I'm learning from that is that most organizations do not classify their information. So how on earth do they protect the valuable stuff? Then you can get into marking and identifying and securing all that sensitive information. Then you need to understand what is sensitive from a commercial point of view or a national point of view, and what is sensitive in terms of privacy and what harm it can do to an individual or groups of individuals. So the first thing is identify the most sensitive information. And the second thing is work out, is that sensitivity due to commercial reasons or is it due to privacy reasons? There's a lot of siloing in our world. Why we have a data protection officer and a chief information security officer, I often wonder, especially if they rarely talk to each other as much as they should. And then why do we have a physical security department that rarely talks to the cyber at all? We're all dealing with the same thing. And in most organizations, data these days and data systems are the core of everything that we do. Make sure you know where your valuable stuff is, work out why it's valuable, keep talking to everybody about how you look after that so that you don't just silo it and do your bit and forget about the fact. I read a paper yesterday, the number of laptops that are stolen from organizations. It's an horrendous number. Have they got encryption on them? Who knows?
I did a job on a laptop that was picked up because I managed to get back some classified information on the aeroplane designs. And the drive's meant to be wiped by the person. You know, there's no security there whatsoever. That came back with a simple check on the hard drive. Whether the laptops are being stolen, sometimes they're sold on. You're still getting that information. We picked up a phone as well from eBay and found a corporate's entire phone book just sitting on it. They'd not even deleted it. And so there are obviously players that are behaving and doing what they should be doing, the most bare minimum things, such as classification of data. You know, you don't want everybody in your company reading your finance data. Most people understand that now, but you still go into companies where that is just wide open. It's just sitting on a shared drive and anybody from any department can read
these
that.
These are the basics.
Yeah.
These are the basics that we're still not doing. How can any equipment be released from an organization until it's been cleared? Because the processes don't work if they exist.
That's obviously not working.
Things can go wrong with that. For instance, when companies go bankrupt and the liquidators are not under an obligation to make sure the gear is cleaned and stuff. So it's a minefield.
There's always going to be breaches. But guys, can we stop the bloody obvious? Can we just do the basics? Shut the doors and lock the windows, for goodness sake.
You highlighted another problem there in cybersecurity as well. And it's not just that we operate in silos within our own company, but we operate in silos within our own companies themselves. So different individuals working on the same problem with slightly different job titles, but they're doing the same thing and they're working in silo away from each other. That isn't being addressed at a communication level. And it reminds me of a really interesting World War II document that was drawn up by the UK. That was how to sabotage business. And part of that is if you separate people off who are doing the same work and you bog them down with so many tasks, the business is doomed to fail. And to some extent, we've taken that book and we've started doing that now. And I feel that in cybersecurity in particular, that's a really, really big problem. It's a serious problem.
I just say that the entire SOE operations playbook seems to be what modern businesses are experiencing. You know, this kind of sabotage, obfuscation, discombobulation, mixed message. I think, you know, the information war that we're in against businesses is sort of beyond cyber. We have to get into seeing how all of that stuff is being done to us.
It's fascinating. And then you throw into that turf wars. And you throw into that the vendors who will send three different vendors will sell three different products to those three different people inside the organization, all working in silos. And then when those three people move, the next three people will buy three more products each. And you end up with this massive legacy. I need to be positive about this, and I mean it from my heart. The cybersecurity world has evolved beyond recognition, even in the last 10 years.
You're positive on that, right? Because it used to be that you could just buy your IT manager a nice fancy dinner and he would buy your product. And now your IT manager doesn't even want to go to dinner with those vendors because he's aware that that will probably come with a sales pitch. And it has changed things. It has made those people making those key decisions actually want to build a relationship and learn a little bit more about the product away from the marketing side, which is something that you very clearly identified a long time ago. And that's just completely taken off because that need is very clearly there.
And how does a vendor prove their longevity, their reliability, their integrity, their work ethic, their reliability? That isn't in a sales pitch.
Definitely not. No. And that's the most important thing when it comes to technology. And I've had experiences of that where, you know, the IT manager or the decision maker has been taken out and they've been shown lovely things and it's come at a discount and then everything's broken once you install it, because actually it wasn't fit. They're a smaller company when they suggest it. You know, they've marketed up from where they are, and the reality of that can actually break your entire system, let alone put your security at risk.
Well, do allow me to finish on a high here, because as I said, I've been in the cybersecurity world since it started, and I have seen such massive changes over that period, from a niche technical function to a business management issue now, which is more often than not addressed at board level, which is massive, massive improvement. There is still a long way to go, but I am seeing huge changes, not just in the way that we do things, but in the sorts of people that are doing them. The modern school of CISO and the modern CISO team are light years away from where they were 10 or 15 years ago. My generation, we were all self-taught. We all made it up as we went along. We now have skills, resources, knowledge. I am hugely encouraged by where we are. Of course, it's not perfect. And of course, the crims are always going to be getting bigger and better than us, and we're always going to be chasing our tails. But I am hugely encouraged by the way our industry is progressing. And I'm very encouraged as well by the way that the more discerning vendors and suppliers are increasingly understanding the importance of a roundness of their offering. There is a service to be provided and a relationship to be built. The SASIG has always known that. I am delighted that we are now becoming much more mainstream in that view. And I am very, very proud of what we've created. I'm very proud of our community. I'm very proud of the way that it's now run by the members, much more than the SASIG team. The future for our industry is golden, and the future for SASIG, I hope, is only just beginning. Now that we're part of 19 Group, I've got some real resource behind me, some real knowledge and expertise. So I always think about, we've had this little tree growing out in the cold and the frost, and now we've been brought into this big greenhouse, and now we can really begin to flourish. And I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to talk about my baby.
And how do you see it growing into the future? Where will SASIG go?
I would like this smaller, more personal approach to sales and marketing really start to take off. I can see there is a change in the wind, and I believe passionately that the smaller, more bespoke, more specialist approach will become the norm. I see SASIG going global. I think our model, it's unique. I have still to find anything like it. And we can take this around the world, because the basic premise is the same. The CISO wants to do a good job. The CISO wants to find the best products and the best solutions that fit in with their plan. And they want to deal with trustworthy vendors who put their interests at heart. And the more that we can develop an environment where that is facilitated, then there is no stopping us.
So Big SASIG is the real trust event of the year, and it begins today for 2025. So we've released on the day that it comes out. So if you are interested in having a look at their event, then go over to their website today and have a look and follow along. So, you know, they say it's not about hard selling. There is a business dinner, and that's what they're going to be doing over the next 2 days. So although it is a lot of events, we went and saw them at the NEC Birmingham. They put on a lot of talks, really, really interesting stuff. There is this vendor-ish, you know, part of that, but it isn't just, oh, we're going to go there and sell each other products. It's about friendship. It's about trust and community and building those long-term relationships. So if you want to see what that looks like, today's a really good day to go and check that out, actually.
We love the spirit of SASIG that we've heard today. To be honest, I think, Martin, it has brightened up our day, really, really brightened things up. And thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Well, it's a pleasure. And remember that all our activities are entirely free to the end user community. So if you want to come along, just join in. We do a webinar every day at 11 o'clock, a couple of meetings a month, and then things throughout the year. And if you are a vendor who gets this, then please also don't hesitate to reach out.
Thank you so much, Martin. Just let us know.
I'm only just nervous about coming across as a grumpy old man that says everybody should pull themselves together.
Not when Andy's mixed it. You won't even sound old. He'll make you sound all like fresh and trip hop.
Cyberspace saved the world. Cybersecurity saved cyberspace. Baby.